Thank you. I chose to sit down because I didn't want to feel too professorial standing up here, so I hope you're okay with that. My challenge is going to be to see the screen. I'm looking down here and you're looking up there. But thank you very much and congratulations again on the 10th anniversary. It's certainly a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation. I was at first taken aback a bit about you want me to speak for an hour and a half on networks. On the one hand. On the other hand, how do I squeeze everything into an hour and a half to get to the main points around high-functioning networks? Fortunately, we had a great lit review done a few years ago that thematically put it into five categories, and I'll get to those in a moment. So thank you very much, and I think we'll get started a little late already, so it's going to be a bit of a challenge, I think, for timing. I see my clock is down there. I do need to declare I'm engaged and remunerated as a consultant with RCC, but anything that I do is certainly vetted through and approved by RCC DC. So the session, I thought it would be easiest and probably flow best to talk about this in five different parts. And these are the parts that came out of the Lit Review in 2014. If you're going to read anything in the literature, and I do have about 30 references at the end of these slides, and I think the slides will be available for you to look up information as you see fit and want to and desire. But it's an online version. It's called Interorganizational Networks, a review of the literature to inform theory and practice, I think it's called. It's not published in a journal. It's actually on the site of the IBM Center for the Business of Government in Washington, D.C. But if you Google Interorganizational Networks and IBM, you will find that on site. And if you're going to read anything, I would recommend you first go there. And in that document are a lot of other really key references. So the five parts are the key concepts around networks, then the types of networks, and there are several different types, and I've outlined about four in this presentation. A little bit on network governance, leadership, and management. Something about network evolution and the life cycle of networks, and then close with evaluation of networks, something that we don't do enough, actually, generally speaking. And then a summary, and if time allows, a bit of time at your table to discuss some of the key concepts and perhaps bring forward some of your practical experiences, and certainly I'm available to answer questions. We're going to break or transition between each part, and I kindly have lined up volunteers from the audience who work in various divisions. Between part one and two, Errol Winter from NRRD will be just bringing to life perhaps some of the theoretical concepts and how they're dealing with that on the ground. Types of networks, Dr. Ali from the White Rock South Surrey division will speak to that. After part three, Dr. David May from Paul River will talk a bit about their experience on the ground in terms of governance, leadership, and management. And after part four, network evolution, Dr. David Butcher, who I understand is my doppelganger from Salt Spring. Hi, David. We get confused apparently from time to time. So we'll hear from him as well. And then there'll be some table talk. So that's the outline, and hopefully we can stick to the time. In terms of key network concepts, the key one, and we talk about this a lot, is the importance of relationships. And Capra sort of frames it this way. On the left, you'll see sort of how we dominantly look at things now, the importance of the nodes or the organizations or the people or the silos. They look like silos in this case, at the expense of the relationships between them, which are depicted here as dotted lines. The whole idea is to sort of shift our thinking to the right, where the dominant thing we're talking about, thinking about, worrying about, dealing with, are the relationships between those nodes or silos or organizations. So we have to shift. The whole idea here is to shift from parts thinking to whole thinking, to systems thinking, to network thinking. And that's not an easy transition to make, because we're really typically, and I wasn't trained that way, and probably many of you weren't. It's something we need to spend a lot more time in terms of development and training to think in terms of systems and in terms of networks, in terms of the whole, not just the parts. So in that thinking, we're shifting from parts to whole, from objects to relationships, and from the contents to the patterns. So those are three important things to keep in mind as we talk about networks and how they work, in particular, how networks can work well. What is a network? And I don't know if you've spent time to think about exactly what is a network. There's several definitions. These are three, and I sort of bolded the ones and the words that really matter. It's about coming together, it's about working together, and it's about, again, the importance of relationships between individuals or organizations. Just because you call something a network doesn't mean it works like one. And unfortunately, there's a lot of networks around, in particular in the health sector, and there's lots even in British Columbia that are, I would say, they're in name only. They may be working well, they may not be. We don't know, they don't know, because they aren't really evaluated or studied that often. And if they are, they're not written up and they're not shared. And that's not a criticism, it's just where we are. We just haven't spent enough time on network research and network evaluation. I think in terms of the traditional organization hierarchy, there's over 100 years of research, and networks are probably two or three decades of research. So it's a relatively new field, and we're all learning together. But the unfortunate thing is, because there are so many networks out there that are called networks and ostensibly working like networks, because we don't know how they're working, there's also a lot of issues with them. And that's undermined, if you will, the science of networks. So we have to sort of bring that back. And this is probably a good point to emphasize that as we go through your network development, that you begin to document your road, your journey, and talk about it in places like this, but elsewhere, and publish. And not just talk about and publish what's working, but more importantly, what's not working, so we don't repeat those same mistakes, which we often do in the network world and elsewhere. So just an encouragement to you that it's important to document how you're doing. And on that note, I was here yesterday, and it was really I was really happy to hear the progress that you're making. And there might not be a lot of new information in this presentation. I hope there's some new things to think about, but I think importantly, it will validate what you're doing. And the network world is a messy world. If it feels messy, looks messy, is confusing, you're in the right world. That's the good news. The bad news is you're in the network world. So it's the sort of thing that you need to expect and work through. When you've seen one network, you've seen one network. And it's just like rural communities. When you've seen one rural community, you've seen one rural community. And sometimes I'm asked, well, can you point to a network that's really working well, with the idea that we can, if we do what they do, we will work well as well. And that is not the case. The best way to do this is to understand the basic principles of network, the key concepts, and then work through the messy process of developing it yourself with those basic principles in mind. And the reason for that is context is everything. It's much like leadership. Networks will be very different depending on where you live and what you do. So again, context is key, and keep that in mind. And be aware of the basic principles, but not be tempted to, as we often are, to emulate. Emulation is the highest form of flattery, but not to sort of take what works elsewhere and think that it can be easily adapted to your situation. That will be a cause for immediate failure. Well, we can learn things that are from long ago, and Aristotle is one of those people. And you might hear me refer to history a little bit more through this presentation, but I'm a firm believer respecting the wisdom of the ages. Aristotle articulated three intellectual virtues, episteme, techne, and phronesis. Episteme, of course, is the root of epistemology. It's knowing about why things happen. Techne is the root of technical, and more pragmatic is knowing how to do things. But the concept of phronesis has been lost. This term has been lost over 2,000 years, and I'm maintaining that we're trying to recapture the essence of that term. And here's what it means. It's vanished, but in Aristotle's mind, it was value-focused. Again, like networks, very context-dependent. Respects the knowledge of everyone, including lay stakeholders. Moves from the concept of even individual knowing and collective knowing to something that we do together. He didn't exactly address the issue of power back then, but recent philosophers like Flaberg here started introducing the concept of power is also important in the concept of phronesis, and it needs to be addressed. So I'm going to talk about power in a minute, but when we talk about collective action, that really means involving actively all of the key players in the hexagram that you're well aware of, the policymakers, the professionals, the academic institutions, the other contributors, the communities, and health administrators. So it's about collectively knowing, and it's about collectively acting. So we have to get redefine and get that concept of collectivity through relationships back in our vocabulary. I don't think it's going to be necessarily a word that we use too much. Phronetic activity, it's more like frenetic activity, I think, but not to be confused. Networks are a means to address, and this is where power and distance comes in, the whole notion of institutionalization. Robert Chambers is an action researcher who did a lot of work in third world countries and really felt there was a huge gap between the researcher and the researched through power. But that can also be extended to the notion of professionals, and that's any profession who has specialized knowledge. And once that happens, it starts to condition our perceptions and can easily prevent us from learning because we think we know things. And that in turn can create a distance between those who know those things and others. And that can be in terms of physical, organizational, social, cognitive kinds of dimensions. And the other danger with that is that powerful people, people with lots of knowledge and lots of power, lots of influence, because it's worked for them in the past, end up with what's called path dependency. They keep using that same knowledge over and over, but the downside is it prevents them from learning, but it also prevents others from learning and addressing novelty and new things. So it's a dangerous path to be on. So in the concept of phronesis, that kind of power has to be addressed head on. And that's a very difficult thing to do. But it's really a matter of, in Chambers' terms, whose reality actually counts. Does your reality count more than anybody else? And just because you're the most powerful and know the most doesn't mean it counts any more than anyone else. So hierarchies tend to, by design, support power, where networks, if they're functioning, tend to mitigate that kind of power because you expose it through the work of the network. Power has also been described in other ways in the literature, power over the network or the collaboration, power to help with the collaboration, or more importantly, most importantly, power for transforming power to others through the collaboration so that they too have that kind of distributed power. We'd also learn from living systems. Capra has done a lot of work in this area, and just sort of recognizing the notion and the importance of nature works, the eco-cycles work, until they get messed up by humans. But it's we need to spend a lot more time learning from what works in natural systems, which is based on non-linearity, i.e. a sort of horizontal network approach, and self-organization. In nature, relationships are key. It's like systems within systems and networks within networks, all the way from cells, as you're well aware of, and organ systems, all the way up to the entire ecosystem. So it's like the web of life. And Dr. Walsher was just talking about a new film, The Serengeti Rule, which I haven't seen yet, and I know you have, Dr. Walsh. It was sort of a good example that talks about how fragile the ecosystem can be, and when you take certain key parts out, the things that can happen in disastrous ways. So it's something that I'm going to certainly look at, but I would encourage others to, the Serengeti Rule. We can learn also from slime mold. This slime goes back thousands of years. And the interesting thing about slime mold is about 900 different species. It looks like dog vomit, and it lives on dead logs. But the interesting thing, and why it's a good metaphor for networks, is they are, when they have abundant supply of food, so call that we have abundant supply of resources, things are going well, they can actually live as singular cells. But when their food source gets scarce, they amass, they come together, just like a network does. And they do that so they can move more quickly down the dead log to find new food. The original theory is that there was a head slime mold or a pacemaker cell or something that said, let's go, guys, we have to find new food. But over the course of research, it was eventually discovered that there's actually a sensing and inherent in all the cells, and it's a pheromone, a chemical. So it was non-hierarchical, and it was a very locally controlled by each slime mold that allowed the amassing of individual cells to come together, move, and then disaggregate once again once the resources have been found and they're well fed. So that's a pheromone sort of equivalent in nature, where both the you could say both the individual and the collective needs are met continuously, much like we want to do with networks. And the key here is what is our intellectual pheromone? What is that magic ingredient that brings us together so that we can work together more cohesively and in the light of scarce resources or needing to do things or move along or take action, that we can do that in a very strong, coordinated way. So the message really there is that if something that's been around for thousands of years looks like dog vomit, lives on dead logs, has no brains, can figure this out, and is still doing this, certainly we can do this. So I'd like to, that's the end of part one, just to give you a bit of an overview of where I'm coming from and framing some of the basic concepts of networks and who we can learn from. So the takeaways here are simply relationships are primary, local context is key, and we really do need some kind of intellectual pheromone to get us on the same page. With that, I'd like to ask Errol Winter. Errol, where are you? And there's a mic here. You got the mic already. Perhaps just to pick up a little bit on these sort of more theoretical concepts, and if you wouldn't mind applying that to your own local situation, and just tell us a bit about your own experience. Thank you.
Thanks, Ron. Appreciate it. Nice segue. I probably could categorize some of my own personal relationships with slime mold over the years. If I think about it, now I'll never be able to get that out of my mind now. When we originally spoke about this, we were talking about how we applied partnerships out in the field. And really, I think how I see partnerships is I see all many different levels of partnerships, and through each level, it seems to be another doorway to go through, to walk through. You know, and those start out with engagement, and then learning and collaboration, and move all the way up to probably, I guess, at the top of the food chain would be something like intimacy and love and those kinds of things. And so along that road, we've found that, just simply by opening the door and asking those questions and just saying, even coming up to other division partners and saying, so what are you guys working on? What projects are you doing? Mm-hmm. To see what's important to that group and see if there's any alignments there for us before we move ahead. And I think it's important, as you mentioned, Ron, to really get an understanding of the basis of what's important to the person that you plan or group you plan to work with. Lately, the Northern Interior has done some work with Indigenous populations, and we've been spending a lot of time in that arena. And we're finding that, again, back to your earlier comment, the paradigm of thinking is completely different. I mean, for us, when we talk about these pieces about relationships in the beginning, we talk about trying to get some basic understanding. And when we were in the meeting, it was a great meeting. We had lots of conversation, but towards the end of the meeting, we had the group went right into this very deep personal conversation, and it was what we would a lot of times term at an intimate level. And I have to say, my context shifted completely, because at first I really didn't know how to manage that. I wasn't expecting it. It was something completely different when we were there. I mean, we were very grateful to be honored by having that piece, but it's just an example of how the paradigm of a different culture sees things in a different way. Probably our group wouldn't have felt to go to that level at that point in our relationship, and yet here all of a sudden we were immersed in it, and we had to decide on how we were going to proceed. And so it left us with a couple of thoughts, and one was that we learned something about our partners in terms of their cultural piece. We weren't as prepared as we probably should have been, because we were left at the end of that thinking, okay, now what? Really, I appreciate it, and it was great to have this this depth of understanding, but where does that go? Like in our culture, I feel like there must be some reciprocal piece. Well, you know, that didn't feel like it was the place to go at the time. And so now we are left with trying to regroup and figure that out again. And we have a good base and a good start, but we need to come back and reevaluate where we are as an individual group.
Okay, great. Thanks, great, for sharing that, and good luck with how you handle those sorts of invited relationships. And then when it's not going the direction that you feel it ought to, how do you deal with that? So that indeed is a challenge, and a very common one, I think. So thank you for sharing that.